Hey, JD here. Welcome to the Meat House. You know, we're just three guys sitting around a table talking about making good meat at home, and once in a while, we wander out in the yard and talk a little brewing, too. You can contact us on our website, themeathouse.com, Facebook and Twitter, both at The Meat House, and you can listen to the podcast with your favorite player, and be sure and rate us 5 stars on iTunes or your favorite listening venue. The Meat House, meat-making entertainment you just don't want to miss. Hey, thanks for listening. Grab a cold brew or a glass of mead, pull up a chair, and hey, we're glad you're here. Welcome to the table. In the house tonight, Ryan Richardson, Jeff Schaus, and my name is J.D. Webb. On the show tonight, Jeff just returned from the Mazer Cup, and so we've got a couple of segments that we're going to devote to that. Jeff is going to give us a recap of his experience there over the weekend. And also, in segment two, talk about demystifying the entry and the judging process. It sounds like there were some pretty major changes to the Mazer Cup this year. And then, of course, segment three, we'll deal with some Facebook friends. We have some questions out there that we thought we'd tackle here at the Meat House. In the meantime, what are we drinking tonight? Let me start this one off, guys. I'm drinking one of the last two BB1s I have tonight. And this is that Bourbon Barrel Braggot. And I got to tell you, you know how last week, Ryan, we talked about aging and time, in a bottle. This is definitely changed from when we all shared it the first time until now. And this thing's probably, almost a year old, if not over a year old. It's smooth as glass now. It doesn't have that alcohol burn like it had in the early stages. It's calmed down quite a bit. Definitely get the wood and the bourbon. Still at 13%, it's going to knock you. It's going to knock you over if you guzzle this thing down. But man, I'm telling you, this would be good in front of a fireplace on any cold night, in any house, anywhere. At any time. This stuff is really good. I'm really loving this stuff. If I do it again, I'm just going to let it sit in the carboy for maybe a year and a couple of months or more, and just let it sit and do its thing. So I definitely think that aging these dark beers is a good thing. Jeff, what'd you pour in your cup tonight, bud?
The cool part about being a judge at the Mazer Cup is that, like a lot of judging situations, and really, guys, the reason you should get into judging, you get cool gift baskets at the end. Like I've said before, I've gotten Star San and PBW and hops and yeast packets, and you know, there are great sponsors for a lot of even small local competitions, and they are extremely grateful for people that take the time to judge. Mazer Cup, obviously no different. Their gift basket is a little different than what I've seen before, because I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but Mazer Cup tends to request more bottles than other competitions, whether it's the home competition or the commercial competition. They tend to ask for one extra bottle just in case something breaks in transit, so that they've got a fresh one to open at best of show. And often, in this case, they have this third extra bottle that made it there intact and wasn't needed at all, that is just sitting there completely intact. And, you know, it's a delicious commercial mead. So what they do is make a gift bag. They have a Mazer Cup International logo on it. It's divided to hold two wine bottles, and they just randomly give you two bottles. They hand you, bags completely randomly, and you get what you get. And so tonight I am enjoying one of my spoils, which is a Piri Pom. I'm not sure. Let's see. I think the name of the meadery or distillery is La Meliere King. It's from Quebec, it looks like. And this is an interesting one. It's a mistel. It's a honey mistel is what they're calling it. And essentially, what I'm getting out of this is that they took a a mead that was in process, kind of like a port, and they added an apple brandy to stop fermentation early. So what I'm ending up with is a very sweet kind of cordial. It's hazy. You know, it has that honey sweetness. It has a definite alcoholic bite, and it has like just enough apple so that I know that this is definitely like an apple flavored beverage. You know, not sweet is not generally my thing, but this is very nice. It's a nice cocktail kind of cordial, and it's a little cool tonight, and I'm enjoying it.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Ryan, what did you put in your glass tonight?
Well, you know how sometimes we've made clean out meads, you know, whether it's a freezer clean out, you're just trying to get rid of the frozen fruit in your freezer, or we've made clean out braggots where you just take the odds and ends of all the greens and the hops you've got, you throw something together. I'm actually doing a bottle clean out during tonight. Sometimes you've got bottles that have been sitting around too long and they, you know, have a shelf life. Are they, you know, you want to drink them before they start their decline, or maybe you just need the bottle space for your next batch. Either way, that's what I'm drinking tonight. I'm drinking a braggot that I made last fall. And I'm drinking it really just because I figure it's certain, the hops are probably pretty well degraded, and I just need the bottle for the next batch I'm going to start to brew here. This is a fresh hopped braggot. So this was one that I had made. I had put a picture on the Facebook page where I had harvested a bunch of wild common hops and brewed up a batch. And if you guys remember, I wasn't thrilled with it when I made it, and I actually made a batch of hop extract or vodka hop extract, and I put a little bit of that in when I would drink it, which actually made it really good. I kind of wanted to see how it would have changed over the last few months. Not bad. It's mellowed out a little bit from some of the flavors that I thought were pretty assertive from these wild hops. But it still needed the hop extract, I think, to make it a little more enjoyable in here. So all in all, I'm doing more of a public service tonight by trying to get that bottle back than than anything else.
Sounds good. Hey, before we move on, I wanted to throw this out there. I got a new project that I'm going to be starting here just shortly. And I thought I was going to have to make a trip out to my local homebrew shop and pick up some yeast. Now, when I make a cider, I typically use the Nottingham ale yeast. I just think it really makes a fantastic, good dry cider. But I had opened up my jar of yeast in the refrigerator, and I was kind of looking through and seeing what I had, if by chance I had some Nottingham fresh out. But I did find, I forgot that I had 3 packets of this Cider House yeast. Now, I don't have any experience with it at all. And I thought, well, you know what? Since I got it, I might as well use it. And so I have no idea what to expect out of this. I have read some reviews on it. Most seem like, you know, people, you know, tend to like it. They say it does a pretty decent job. So for this batch, it's, you know, the typical treetop, not from concentrate to apple juice that I picked up. I've got 5.5 gallons of it. And I'm going to throw some caramelized clover honey in it this time. Not real dark, just a light caramelization on it, just enough to get the gravity up to around 1070 or so. I don't like to go over that. And then let that ferment away. And then what I was thinking about doing was throwing in some wood chips during fermentation. It's common practice with some of these wine kits. And it, you know, I'm not looking for the wood necessarily, as I'm looking for the mouthfeel that may develop from the wood. Now, if there's some, you know, residual, you know, oak flavoring from it, then hey, that's a good thing, because the end result is once it goes into the carboy for a little aging, it's going to go in with about 3 ounces of bourbon-soaked oak and roughly 16 ounces of bourbon, but that's going to be kind of a taste test because it may only wind up to be, you know, just a cup. I'm not looking for a real strong bourbon flavor. I'm looking for that bourbon barrel flavor, and to me, there's a big difference. So just thought I'd throw that out to you guys and see what you think, Ryan.
First of all, I love the idea of putting in oak during primary fermentation. I've done that a couple of times now, and you're right. You don't necessarily get that oaky, you know, or over-oaked flavor from it, but you do tend to pick up some mouthfeel, and you get some of the tannin from that as well in a little more of a complex way than essentially dry hopping, you know, your oak or throwing it in at the end. So I like that idea a lot. I think you can also create layers if you put some oak in primary and then some oak in tertiary or aging. So I think you can do some work there. I also like the idea, we're trying to get a bourbon barrel flavor. I like creating, like I was talking about last week, some of these oak tinctures. And if you would have had to start it probably 3 months ago, but if you take some of that bourbon, you know, and you oak it, put it in a mason jar with 3 ounces of oak chips and let it sit for 3 months, you end up with that really, really oaky, you know, now you've got a really, really, essentially an oak bourbon extract, and you can add that too. So I think there's a couple of ways to play with it, but I've tried to get some of that flavor as well. And that was one way that I had discovered, to at least give it a shot.
Well, it just so happens. I keep a good supply of bourbon oaked wood on the shelf all the time. I've got several mason jars that have been sitting there for, like you say, months. So I'm prepared for that. Jeff, I was also thinking about steeping some honey malt. Maybe a pound, pound and a half maybe, just to kind of fortify, give it that kind of a honey aroma. There may be some residual sweetness that comes out of it too. I'm not looking for a whole lot, but what I'm looking for is more that honey aroma. And I guess instead of calling this a cider, it's technically a sizer because we are using honey.
Yes. And I'm sorry, you were talking about honey malt, steeping some of that in there.
Yeah.
And you're talking about steeping as opposed to boiling it to get the,
right.
Okay.
I like Ryan's, you know, Ryan went into this, you know, we were talking about one of the braggarts he's made, last week, and he loves to steep his grains in you know, room temperature water. So this is what I'm thinking about.
Yeah, and I've done like cold soaks of the dark grains, which is essentially exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
For things like porters and stouts, and I'm not really familiar with honey malt, but I think it could be an interesting idea. It's a little different honey character, as I understand it, as what that imparts. It's definitely worth a try. I'm all for it. And I will second Ryan in that. I love the idea of, what you're going for with adding some oak in primary too.
Yeah. I've got to get a couple of boxes prepared for you guys before I drink it all. I've got the two honey braggots, might as well call blonde braggots, I guess, as opposed to, you know, some of the darker ones that I've made. I got to get them in the bottles and get them out to you guys. The honey malt really, really kind of fortifies that honey aroma. I kind of like that idea. You know, what flavor it adds to it, I don't know. I mean, if you can pick out honey malt versus the honey, best of luck. Let me know if you can do that or not. But anyway, you know, that's I'm going to try to get this project started before the end of the week, and looking for some good results from it. Jeff just returned from the Mazer Cup,
and actually, before I get into the Mazer Cup stuff, can I throw out my own cider story here?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, guys, I have this love-hate relationship with label peelers now, and it's hate in a good way, because I keep getting emails from them, and I keep getting emails with fantastic deals that are really, really hard to say no to. About a week and a half ago, I got one that they had I think it was a mixed berry cider kit that they were selling at a pretty great price. And I said, you know, it's been a while since I've done a cider, and mixed berry sounds good. And that sounds like it would be a great summertime treat. You know, we might serve that the big 4th of July shindig. Yeah. I will jump on that and I will get this kit. So I got the kit. I ordered it. 2 days later, it arrived on my doorstep. My wife, you know, opened up the box. She sends me this message while I'm at work. Hey, your cider came, but it's not mixed berry.
Oh no.
It was regular plain Jane apple cider.
Put your own berries in it.
So, you know, I gave label peelers a quick call and said, hey, you know, I double checked my invoice. I double checked the paper invoice that came with it. What I ordered was mixed berry. It's showing mixed berry all over the place, but I ended up with plain cider. They're like, wow, we are so sorry. That's our mistake. That's our goof. So here's the deal. We'll get this mixed berry cider out to you ASAP. Meantime, we can do two things. We can send you a label. You can ship that cider kit back to us, or, you know, it's going to cost us about $15 to ship that to you, or to ship it back to us. Yeah. If you want, we could take $15 off of the price of that cider kit and let you just keep both.
There you go.
And I said, yeah, that sounds more than fair. So, you know, label peelers, love the customer service. And now I have a plain cider kit and a mixed berry cider kit. And so, question for you guys. Neither of these kits actually came with the Cider House mead, not Cider House mead, the Cider House yeast that you typically get when you buy these from a homebrew supply store. And I thought about just going and picking some up from my homebrew supply, but it occurs to me that I have this container of yeasts in my my fridge that are going unused and would probably be great in this. You know, I've got some USO5. I've got some Nottingham. What do you guys think? What should I put in this?
Well, it didn't come with any Cider House yeast. Did it come with Cider House rules?
No, but I've got that on DVD, I think.
Yeah.
But I'm pumped.
What do you think, Ryan?
It's almost a found cider kit, right? Try some of the yeast you've been sitting on, and I mean, JD loves Nottingham. Yeah. I knew what he was going to say. I know he's going to say that. Yeah. But yeah, try that, or maybe try something even a little more out there and see what happens. I think it's perfect for experimenting.
Yeah, my dilemma a little bit is, you know, what do I use for what? I kind of like the idea of using USO5 for the mixed berry, just so it's a nice clean ferment and we get the berry character out of that. And I kind of like the idea of doing some kind of a sizer and using Nottingham with the apple because, you know, yeah. Why not? Let's have some fun with this.
I think you're on something there. The Nottingham, cool. I can tell you, is going to give you that English ale, that English cider. If you add, you know, whether you have to add honey or sugar or whatever, make sure you check the gravity. Don't go over 1070. I don't know what the I think all that is just apple juice concentrate, like you get in the frozen cans, but it's like a big bag of it. And you have to add your water. So you'll probably wind up with a starting, a gravity of somewhere around 1050, maybe 1052 or so.
Right. And they do recommend adding a pound or 2 pounds of what is it? The corn sugar.
I mean, you can use brown sugar, table sugar, you know, I mean, cane sugar, honey. Whatever you want. All you're basically doing is getting the gravity, or, you know, getting the gravity up, getting the alcohol up, because you're not going to be able to – you'll get a little bit of caramelization or caramel flavor out of the brown sugar, but not a whole lot, and that might add something to the cider itself. I've always used honey, so I couldn't tell you one way or another if brown sugar really – you know, I mean, you're only looking at a couple of pounds at this point. But I would not take the gravity over about 1070 with the Nottingham and just let it do its thing. Treat it like a mead, aerate the hell out of it. You know, give it a spin or two a couple times a day to degas it. And then let it ride after, say, the seventh day. And let it finish off, and you're going to wind up with some incredibly good dry English style cider. I've had Magners and one other that I can't remember the name, and it should come a close second to even a good dry Magners cider. So I think you're on to something there. Use the 05 for the berry, and the Nottingham for the regular apple.
Sounds like a plan.
Cool.
All right. So, well, Mazer Cup.
Yeah, Mazer Cup. You spent the weekend there. You got to judge some things. Thank you for keeping tabs on it for us on our Facebook page and posting the results. Quite a few kudos from folks out there, our listeners who were watching and anxiously watching. We're able to see the results that got posted up. So tell us about your experience there.
Okay, well, the first thing I need to say is, I was judging for 2 days, and judging is it can be a little mentally stressful. You know, you're kind of like, what is this flavor? What am I tasting? There's a lot of gears working. And the time really does fly by when you're at that judging table and you're judging and trying to give your best evaluation. But there were a lot of people involved in this, in Mazer Cup that, their names don't appear on judges' sheets. The contest organizers, there were tabulators, there were the guys that were stewarding tables and, handling the bottle room and running the various meads out to tables to be judged. There was, I say this in no small way, an army of people that were voluntarily giving their time and their effort and just working their tails off to make this thing a success. So a profound thank you to everyone involved, to everyone that volunteered and helped make it work, because wow, you guys were working your tails off, and I totally noticed. The success of this is in no small part due to so many people giving so much of their time and energy for something we're all passionate about, and I appreciate the hell out of that. I went out to Mazer Cup, and I almost didn't make it. I had a job change at the end of January that really threw a wrench in a lot of my plans. I had essentially no PTO, so I didn't get to make the AMMA conference, even though I really wanted to. I tried to do this on the cheap, and I think I think I lost out a lot to that. I didn't stay out as late as I wanted to. I wound up actually having really terrible sleep while I was there, just I think due to the elevation more than anything. So I was kind of, dragging for a lot of it and probably not as social as I wanted to be. It was a really great, really intense weekend, and I'm really pleased to have gotten to meet so many people that I've only interacted with online or on the show. Great to finally shake hands and meet people in person. Let me cut to the chase. I got into the Denver Boulder area, literally maybe a half hour before the calibration that Pete Bakovich was running. And that I thought was really useful for just, you know, getting my focus together and being able to taste and judge things. Hunter's Moon Meadery provided a couple meads that we got to taste and try and kind of evaluate together as a group. That was really helpful. And Pete actually had a comment that I really liked that I think is important for judges to remember, is that you don't get to take your points home with you. Meaning, don't be afraid to be generous. You know, if people are putting a lot of effort into making these, be fair, but don't be stingy. And I took that to heart. I think a lot of the judges did, actually. So let me see here. The first session that I judged was commercial Friday morning, and it was a semi-sweet other fruit and vegetable category. Now, this a lot of the meads that I tasted were really fruit heavy. They had a lot of the like the tartness tannin going on. Really, I felt like they came off more off dry than semi sweet, and I really enjoyed a lot of the commercial stuff I judged. And you know, let me say this: the caliber of meads that I was tasting at Mazer Cup, whether they were commercial or home, oh my gosh, guys, like. You guys brought it in a big way. Everything was very, very good. And the judging process of this was really interesting. For the commercial category, there were three judges for each entry, and usually we had it set where there were essentially two teams of three judges at a table. And in this first session, I got to sit across from our former guest, Michael Fairbrother. It was real fun to hear some of his input and stuff while he was judging too. Lots of good experience and experienced judges all around, of course, but throughout to our former guest, Michael Fairbrother. It was really great to be able to judge with experienced people too, because, you know, as we talked, they pointed out things that I missed. I pointed out things that they missed. Our scores kind of changed. And I don't feel like anybody was really like pushing one way or the other. I think it was very fair. And I really appreciated just, you know, the open dialogue that we could have after we all did our kind of initial impressions there.
Did you find, I know you were able to sample both the home homebrewed mead as well as the commercial mead. Did you find significant differences between, I guess we could take it from category, say Melomels or berry meads or herb vegetable type meads or braggots? Did you discern any significant difference between homebrewed and commercial mead?
You know, yes and no. I think the commercial meads, they have better equipment, frankly. So there was more polish, there was more filtering done. They were a little bit more refined in some cases. My approach to judging was a little different because, you know, you're talking to a commercial meadery that, honestly, this product is probably on a shelf somewhere.
Right.
So, you know, the advice that I'm giving in that case is more along the lines of, you know, who are you marketing this? How are you marketing this? What is this good for? Is this, you know, some of those are really heavy. And I said, you know, this is something I would sell in a smaller bottle, more as like an after dinner sipper. Some of them were very refreshing. You know, I could say, hey, yeah, sell this in a 750, sell this to open up and share with a bunch of people. I mean, yeah, the advice you're giving to commercial mead makers is a little different because a home mead maker wants to know, is this good? What could I do better? That said, quality-wise, there was, you know, minor differences. The home mead makers are really doing great things. And I tasted several home meads that I thought were easily comparable to some of the commercial meads that I tasted.
So home mead makers have really stepped up the game then, as far as home brewing, home mead making goes. Yeah,
absolutely.
Interesting.
So,
let me ask you a related question to that. Do you think that people have stepped up their game because of competitions like the Mazer Cup, which are so, you've got a limited number of spots, and I understand that they filled all those spots in like 5 hours.
Well,
or something like that. You've got Dormer's Cup. You've got these big, very popular competitions. And a lot of people are participating. So do you think it's because of that that people have stepped up their game at home in order to be able to compete or attempt a medal?
I think so. I think to some extent, people are stepping up their game because the competitions are getting bigger. And I did not mention this. This was the biggest year yet for Mazer Cup. They had 109 judges, including myself.
Wow.
That was a record for the number of judges. Because they had so many judge volunteers, they were actually able to increase their entry cap, too. Right. They had an initial 500, which I think we talked about on the show. Those spots got filled in less than 5 hours.
Right.
And then I want to say a week or two later, they elected to open up another 200 spots.
Wow, yeah.
Now, not everybody that entered got to have their stuff judged. We ended up with, I think they said, 620 meads on the home side that were judged. That is still a phenomenally large number of meads to judge. The competition is there. People want to get out and compete. I don't know if you guys heard the announcement, but part of the closing ceremony at Mazer Cup it was announced that next year's Mazer Cup, the best of show, is going to have a cash prize of $500 donated by Mike Fall at Rabbit's Foot Meadery, I believe.
Wraps it up. That takes it to another notch.
There is now a monetary... granted, for all that we are putting into this hobby, $500 is a drop in the bucket, but it is still a very sizable cash prize to the best of show. And, may the best man win.
Sure,
Best man or woman.
Ryan, what's your take on that? I mean, that really ramps it up.
Well, it's like my high school gym coach used to say, competition brings out the best, boys.
Yeah.
So, I think that there is a lot of different reasons for competing. I think there's some people who like the medal. They have a competitive drive and they want to win things and they want to earn medals and that kind of thing. I think there's other people who really enjoy the feedback because it's having a Carvin Wilson or a Pete Baklich or a Jeff Shout judge your stuff objectively is a lot different than having Bernie down the road who just likes free sauce telling you it's great.
Right. Yeah. True. True.
So I think there's a lot of different reasons for entering. And I think that, this is definitely an opportunity for people to have amazing mead palettes, giving them feedback. And I think it's also an opportunity to really, if you believe that you are in that upper echelon, I mean, this is the medal or the plaque or the trophy that's probably going to mean the most to you, or one of the most to you, other than maybe, some of the other big competitions out there, sitting on your shelf.
Well, this is kind of the Academy Awards of mead making, right? I mean, this is like,
This
is like the one,
Yeah, there's the, I mean, absolutely. You know, the Mazer Cup is definitely, like you said, the Academy Awards. I don't know. I mean, last year at the National Homebrew Competition, there were almost 9,000 entries. You know, Mazer Cup had 700, right? National Homebrew Competition had 9,000. Now,
yeah.
I don't know how many of those are mead. Maybe a couple hundred, 200, 300, 500. I don't know.
Yeah.
But in sheer volume, it's definitely, you know, this is where you go for All About Mead. There are more subcategories of mead judged at the Mazer Cup than probably at any other competition. So, yeah, like I said, that Mazer Cup trophy is probably going to, I mean, I'm not going to tell you what means more, having a national homebrew competition medal or a Mazer Cup trophy. If you're at that level, just win both and don't worry about it.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, go ahead. I'll let you go.
Well, the afternoon for my commercial entry judging on Friday was a very different animal because I didn't have an assigned category at first. So what they did was they kind of held on to me and said, okay, well, when we get to the mini best of shows for categories, we're going to swap you in for a fresh palate. Because it is so easy to get a palate burnout at these. You're judging so much. And so I got to judge a mini best of show for, let's see, that was, I want to say, I didn't even note what category that was. Sweet Session Strength Meats. That's right. Sweet Session Strength Meats was one of the categories I was a mini boss judge on. The difference between judging first round and judging mini boss is staggering because you don't fill out a score sheet in the mini boss round. You literally just sip the meats and you talk about them. And you try to come to a consensus as to, you know, we had five meats in this category that were all obviously very good. So, you know, as far as technical merit, as far as enjoyability, drinkability, which of these should we place at first, second, third?
Interesting.
And then two obviously just, you know, didn't get a medal. And there was a lot of talk and a lot of feedback, but we didn't write anything down. We didn't get to see the first round score sheets. This was just a very holistic kind of evaluation. And I kind of like that more than filling out score sheets, to be honest with you, because I think it was a little less categorized and a little more holistic, and I appreciated that that approach a little bit more.
Interesting, yeah.
How many judges were at that table talking about the mini best of show?
That was a team of three again.
Team of three.
Mm-hmm.
And did you have – so you didn't write anything down, but was there a printed guideline – that said these are, you know, or a score sheet saying, even though you're not writing things down, this is the basis of how you're judging these.
Well, you're still giving your category, you know, breakdowns as far as the style sheet, if you will. And you're still given the flight information, the information that the entrants put in as far as, well, this one has, you know, chilies and lime and blah, 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 blah. That by itself is given to you, but other than that, very little else. And I took a lot of notes just because I am a note taker by nature. And those didn't get tabulated or anything of the sort. They were just for my information and for my, like, what I appreciated, what I, you know, thought was good about each of the meads. But yeah, no, literally you go in with very little information apart from the criteria you're supposed to be judging on and the meads themselves, and you come out with a first, a second, and a third.
You said that you enjoyed that process or that you liked it or appreciated it better than, say, going through a score sheet process. can you expand on that? Why you like that? I'm someone a little bit. I might swing on the other way of the pendulum. I might say that process, a disciplined process or a structure, can actually be freeing. Saying that if I go to somebody and we're judging mini boss and I'm going to just assume these are all amazing. So let's just say I say 45, and somebody else is like, well, I didn't like that one as much. Okay, tell me about where you had it. You know, let's talk about why I gave it a 45 and why you think it's only a 40 or right. something like that.
Let's actually save that for the next segment, because that's going to have everything to do with, with the scoring and judging process that Jeff experienced. If you can remember all that, can you remember everything you just asked, Ryan?
It's on record.
We'll put a pin on that. Because that does actually tie into my.
I can't rewind. I can't do an instant playbacks.
You know, and there is an extent to which I want to talk about that when it comes to the home competition too, because we had new score sheets from the BJCP for the home competition this year too, and I want to touch on those.
Yeah.
But yeah. So.
What was the most unique? Actually, I want to, a couple of questions here, actually all rolled up in one. What was the most unique mead that you tasted, and what was the best mead that you tasted?
So I'm going to have to say, as a judge, I should probably remain confidential on that one.
Well, just tell. Can you tell us if it was a berry or a piment or without giving away the? I don't know how you'd answer that.
Yeah, it's a little tough to answer, and I owe you guys some info on my notes on this session, because session meads, we're talking about these a lot. They're definitely a bee in my bonnet, and I'd say a good third of the mead ideas I have now, thanks to being at Mazer Cup, are just from that mini boss session and the copious quantity of notes that I took. So
let's throw it that way then. I mean, when because you and I talked on the phone a couple of times when you were there, mm-hmm. one of the questions I asked you was about dry meads, whether I don't know how I posed it, but in essence, the dry meads are not as well. I don't know how you put it. I don't want to say not as well accepted, but not recognized as much as sweet meads. Did you find were there more dry meads there? Do you think?
I didn't get a chance to judge many of the dry competition sessions.
Yeah.
I will say, I think the table next to ours in one of my homebrew sessions had the dry component to something I was judging semi-sweet in, and I know there were definitely less dry entries than there were semi-sweet or even sweet. I will say that looking at my score sheets, I still think my palate is definitely skewed for what dry means versus what semi-sweet means. My palate for dry is apparently what a lot of other judges think is so dry that a Death Valley rattlesnake would spit on it in sympathy.
Well, out of curiosity, because we've had this discussion before here at the Mead House about dry meads not really being that. All that recognized when it comes to these competitions, because mm-hmm. I mean, we all know sweet sells. Everybody loves sweet things, and
And the one thing I do sincerely appreciate about the Mazer Cup is that they actually have a breakdown in categories between sweet, semi-sweet, and dry. You don't find that at any other even mead focused competition that I've seen. And I appreciate that they go that extra mile, because I think if you put a dry mead and a sweet mead or a semi-sweet mead in the same flight at the sip test level, the dry mead is just at a disadvantage. It just is. And I think honestly, not to gripe, but even like a slightly sweeter dry mead versus, you know, absolutely bone dry mead, probably gonna do better. This competition. But that's my two cents. I have not done empirical study as far as entering a slightly sweeter versus a, you know, absolutely bone dry mead and seeing which does better. That might be something worth trying, but that's speculation at this point.
Well, bottom line, before we move into the next segment, did you have a good time?
I had a great time. And oh my God.
Would you do it again?
I am absolutely going to do it again. I am absolutely not going to do it on the cheap next year. because I, like I said, I felt like I missed out. I lost out. I did not go to the mead mixer Friday night. I was waffling whether or not to go. You know, do I spend the extra $65 to go? Do I hang out? Do I do the after party? Finally, I got to the end of Friday and was just exhausted from just poor sleep and feeling run down. So I was like, I should probably, you know, rest up before I, you know, go do other stuff. And I wound up crashing really early and going to bed and missing the whole thing. And there was a great time had.
Maybe we could start a GoFundMe page for Jeff's trip to the Mazer Cup.
I think I can pay my own way.
Oh my God. I see GoFundMe pages for everything under the sun. The Mead House GoFundMe page. Let's send Jeff to Mazer Cup.
What I think we should consider, though, you know, I know generally the mead mixer is for meaderies. I think it would be fun to do a mead house table at the mead mixer, though.
You know, I think it would be fun to record a show there. You know, we're not talking going live with it, on the spot, but record one of our weekly shows there. I think that would be a blast.
That could be a hoot.
I wasn't able to join Jeff this year at the Mazer Cup. Hopefully next year.
But we can have two GoFundMe pages.
Yeah. At HomebrewCon, you know, there's different nights, you know, social nights. And the first night is typically breweries, or it was last year. So a lot of the breweries had booze, and you get to go around and sample those. The next night, and it's usually the night that most people consider the pinnacle night, is called Club Night. And that's where all of these homebrew clubs put booths up, and they're all pouring their homebrew, you know, for all the other attendees. It would be fun, I think, of what you're describing, Jeff, if there was like a club night at Mazer Cup, where whether they're officially clubs or unofficial clubs, you know, are pouring mead, you know, their homebrew mead for all of the attendees.
That could be fun. And you know, as far as social nights go, there is another thank you I need to throw out, because Carvin Wilson, oh my gosh. You know, every night at Mazer Cup, after party at Carvin's suite, is, you know, I met a lot of people there. I tried a lot of great meads. You show up, most people have a bottle of something they've made, and they're just like, oh, your glass is empty. Here, let me fix that for you. And I forget exactly which charity or purpose Carvin was collecting money for, but every night there was a bowl passed around to collect some cash, and Carvin matched the amount put in there for that cause. And you know, that, and you know, go talk to Carvin. He is such a great guy. He has a lot of insight. He does a lot of cool stuff, and just very positive. I really enjoyed speaking with him. The few times that I got to hang out with him at Mazer Cup, I mean, you know, a lot of good input from him. So thank you, Carvin. That, you know, awesome.
Did you get to try his golden raspberry?
I did not get to try the golden raspberry. I did get to try some very cool things that he did. He did a an elderberry that I tried.
Cucumber lime?
No, not the cucumber lime either. There is a lot of good stuff that Carvin has made, I'm sure, that I didn't get to try. He had this wild elderberry that I had tried that he actually made with completely non-Saccharomyces ferment. It was Delbrechia, I think, was the strain that he was using. Correct me if I'm wrong, Carvin. It was the most ridiculously smooth berry mead I have ever tasted. It literally went down like water. There was that hint of the tannin astringency just from the elderberries, and oh my gosh, it blew my mind. And it's another page in the ideas Jeff has after Mazer Cup, because wow, that was good.
Wow, sounds good. Moving right along, guys. There's another part of the Mazer Cup that Jeff experienced there over the weekend, and it has more to do with the actual judging and that whole process. And there's been some changes, Jeff, and you kind of described some of them to us, or at least to me, a couple times when we talk on the phone. One of the things that I picked up on, and I think you made a post about it or sent an email to us, I don't recall which, but you talked about how the judging was more like points scored in the wine industry. Can you break that down for us a little bit better, or am I even saying it right?
You're off there to some degree. The thing I was talking about was that there is a big difference between the commercial side and the homebrew side in terms of scale.
Yeah.
If you guys go to your local liquor store and look at the wine section, even sometimes the beer section, you'll see these little flags on it that they say scores 96, 98 right. out of 100.
Yeah.
This is that kind of competition. The scores where that scores, 98, your judging composite score at Mazer Cup could very well end up on a mead bottle, because this is exactly what they're talking about. That said, the home competition is just out of 50 points. I don't know why exactly they do 50 versus 100. I know on
they're using BJCP scoring, right? Which is out of 50.
Right. In the home competition, they're using BJCP scoring, which is out of 50.
That's what I mean. That's right. Probably why it's out of 50, right?
Right. And I think really the commercial competition is using out of 100, because 98 out of 100 is probably just easier for consumers to understand. They look at that and say, oh, wow, 98%. Well, that's pretty dang good.
Yeah.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
So that was a minor difference that I just hit on. And, one of the big differences this year was there was a new score sheet from the BJCP, which I liked and I didn't like for some reasons. It was very well broken down, I thought, as far as the various components of mead. So there were basically like little scalar indicators, for things like honey character, sweetness, acidity, tannin, alcohol strength, things like that. And rather than, assigning a numerical value, you just kind of put a little check mark or a little X where on this continuum you thought it landed. And there was a little blank next to it for you to add comments. I did not comment on every single line because I didn't necessarily think that everything needed commentary on, but when it stood out to me or it was a little on the lax side, I tried to make a comment about it. I tried to keep my comments specific and useful. I really appreciated the structure and the thought that went into this. In some ways, though, I was a little bit frustrated in trying to fill out a judging sheet, because the ability to say, okay, well, you've got this good fruit character, and you've got this acid character, and you've got this body character, this the really deep, rich body, there wasn't as much space for me to talk about how all those characteristics interacted. The only time I really got to do that was the four or five lines at the end where it was kind of like the general impression section. And I like to talk a little bit more holistically about how parts interact. That was a little frustrating to me. And I feel like I could have filled up more of the paper if I had a little bit more space to just talk as opposed to all these little components. That said, we're talking about a competition where we're judging 620 entries. And I've said before, part of me wonders if the fact that I didn't get as much feedback at Mazer Cup as I do from other entries is because, there's just a lot more to judge. I think nail on the head. I think, we're trying to get through a lot of entries and, frankly, writing a paragraph about appearance and a paragraph about, aroma and a paragraph about flavor and then a paragraph about the general impression altogether, that takes a lot of time.
I had
good things and I had bad things that I felt about the score sheets. But one of the things that I really wanted to talk about, I really want to give some of our listeners some insight as to what goes on with judging and how these are evaluated and kind of give you a heads up as far as what you should know before you enter and what you should know when you get your score sheets. So as far as what you should know when you enter, I kind of want to talk about how the wines are presented. The meads are presented. Judging at different competitions previously, every competition that I've judged before the Mazer Cup, we got our entries in little plastic cups. And, that from a standpoint of, well, this is a lot of glassware to wash, I was okay with that. I didn't complain. It's just kind of understandable.
Clear plastic cups?
Right. The little clear, it's like 4 or 6 ounces. I take that back. One of them had, they were clear plastic cups, but they were in the, they were more of the, I want to say like the size of a Red Solo cup. If you guys follow me there, about a pint.
Right. Yeah.
But that's as maybe the Mazer Cup, actually had legitimate, wine glasses. I want to say they're the 5 ounce, white wine size, if I'm not mistaken. And your pour is generally about 2 ounces in that, and it's always room temperature. So, if you guys want a good idea of what the judges are going to be looking at or how the judges are going to see your mead, when it's entered, get yourself a wine glass, bring your mead to room temperature, pour out a couple ounces, and you can evaluate it in roughly the same condition that a judge would. I would recommend that because, the shape of the glass is going to affect the aroma. The temperature is going to affect not only the aroma, but also the flavor. So you may catch a characteristic at room temperature that you miss if you're presenting, if you're like serving your meads usually at,
cold
refrigerator temperature. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people like to keg, bottle, put it in the refrigerator, serve it cold basically. So you're saying, put it in a, I'm wondering if, Ryan, help me out here for the second time. What's the name of those, what's the name of those bourbon glasses?
A nosing glass?
The Glencairn.
Yep.
So try get yourself a Glencairn and use one of those, you think?
Well, maybe. I would say just use a wine glass because that's what the judges are using. Okay. I mean, Glencairn, I've gotten to use them a couple of times. They definitely give you a great nose. You get a total a much different appreciation than you would with a different kind of glass. But no, the use what the judges are going to use.
Use what the judges use. Okay.
You'll get a much clearer example of what the judges are going to taste. Do that
so,
first.
So, Jeff, are you saying that in from what you understand, all the meads, regardless of style, were all served at room temperature?
Correct.
So even I was telling you about, like, I asked you a little while ago if you had tried Carvin's cucumber lime mead. That's kind of one of his standards that he always makes and always has on tap. Mm-hmm. And it is meant, it's light, it's refreshing, it's session strength, and it's designed to be served cold and carbonated. So are you saying that that's something else that people should take into consideration, that if you've got a mead that's designed to be served at a cold temperature, you know, you maybe if it's not that as good at room temperature, you know, you shouldn't enter it?
Well, no, I'm saying you should try it at room temperature and, you know, in that circumstance to see if you do want to enter it, or to at least know that, you know, there may be things you're missing. You know, I will tell you, I entered my the IPA Braggot that you guys tried out, and I kind of wish I had known that, you know, there was not going to be chilling, there was not going to be differences in glassware, because, you know, at my house, I serve it in a pint glass. I serve it in a pub pint glass, and I serve it bone cold. Or not bone cold, like
ice cold.
Ice cold, refrigerator cold. Thank you. I'm getting stuck on bone dry again. It's one of those things like, man, at least before filling out my entry, I might have liked to try it that way and see, you know, did that change the way I perceive it? Is it more of a semi-sweet or is it more dry now?
Well, and we've talked about in the past, you know, and most recently about how temperature affects the flavor.
Sure.
You know, I mean, case in point, this BB1 that I'm drinking tonight, and I was ice cold when I pulled it out of the refrigerator. You take the first sip, and yeah, it's good, but I taste a whole lot more in it now that it is, and I don't have my little digital gizmo here, but I'm guessing it's probably about 65, 68 degrees. I taste a whole lot more in it now.
Yeah.
So, but you know, when it comes to, I kind of get what Ryan's talking about, because some of the things we made are meant to serve and be drunk ice cold.
Yeah.
But in the judging process, aren't we to overlook that part? Aren't we looking for specific things about it, regardless of whether it's cold or room temperature? Or am I asking that wrong?
No, I think the judging characteristics, you are supposed to be looking at it. Well, let's put it this way. The entries sat in the bottle room so that they could all acclimate to the same temperature. They could all be essentially on an even playing field.
Yeah.
And that's the even playing field is just part of the competition. But, you know, I think it is worth knowing what you're putting out there and what it's going to present as. Because, no, it's not going to be exactly like you serve it at home. It's just not.
Yeah.
So the other part I wanted to talk about is more along the lines of what to do with your score sheets, or how to interpret your score sheets, I should say. Because, you know, I've gotten a number of like packets of score sheets from Mazer Cup or from other competitions. And, you know, usually you get like two score sheets, and the top one is stamped pushed around two. And then there's a second score sheet with that. Now, maybe this is my flippancy in looking at these, but in years past, when I got that packet, I went, okay, well, so this first one is my round one score sheet. And the second one is my round two score sheet. No.
No?
No. They're both your round one score sheets.
Really?
Because the home competition is two judges per team, and we had three judges per I'm sorry three teams of judges per table, six people, along with a table steward that was, you know, they were tallying our results, they were double checking our math, they were calling up for the next entry when we were ready for it. You know, just part of that army of people keeping things moving and keeping things well organized and going that I was talking about, that I was ever so grateful for. You know, that working their tails off. But no, these score sheets are just your round one score sheets. The mini best of show, when they get pushed around two, doesn't have a score sheet. It's like I was talking about with the commercial one. They set all of the ones that were pushed to best of show out, and they decide what takes first, what takes second, what takes third. It's not a point value at that point. It's about, you know, a more holistic appreciation of the meat. So you take, for example, one of the score sheets that Chris got a while back for one of his, where he scored 45 points, but he didn't get didn't medal or something like that, I think was the situation.
Right. Yeah.
The ones that medaled might not have gotten 45 points in first round. The judges that did that best of show may not have been the same judges that awarded him 45 points. They didn't see the score sheets. They evaluated a little bit more holistically. They said, well, this is the best technically created. This is, you know, the most enjoyable to drink. This has the most presentation of fruits. You know, the bottom line is, you know, that that score applies to the first round and the first round only. And beyond that, you're getting a much more subjective evaluation when it comes to the metal.
Interesting. So, is there, but are any of those, but there's no comments, right? In that second round, there's no comments that go down on the score sheet, or yes?
Correct. There's no comments. The rationale as to why one got first, second, or third is known to the judges, but that's not entered onto a score sheet. It's not provided to the participants, unfortunately.
And so there's nothing for the participant to know what he needs to improve then if he wants to make that same recipe again and enter it, right?
Well, the first round judges should have given him –
other than the first round.
Right. They should have given guidance in that regard. As far as what could be improved on, what was done well, and things like that. But as far as what made it more competitive against, you know, 3 to 9 other entries, it's a little up in the air. And realistically, unless you're going to compete against those 3 to 9 other entries in a future competition, exactly, I'm not sure how helpful it's going to be at that point. We're really talking about, and if I can say this about the best of show commercial judging that I did, we're talking about finite little minor things, like, you know, the do we point out that this one is a little bit more easy drinking or is lighter and more refreshing and, you know, more fun to drink versus this one, which is, you know, more technically impressive because there's no like fermentation flaws and all of the different fruit characters you can pick out. It's not muddled in any way and blah, blah, blah. It's like very minor, finite things that often separate, you know, that first place from the also ran.
Interesting. What do you think about all that, Ryan?
Yeah, I think that when you are in a situation like that where there are so many high quality entries, it is those little nuances that probably separate the best, you know, that separate first, second, third, and also ran, you know, that kind of thing. And when I asked you that question earlier, when I was trying to say that there is freedom within structure, of being able to say, I got a 45 on this, you know, and that's the top score. Why don't you think it's the top, you know, and saying, you know, well, maybe what you're describing is that it doesn't come down to necessarily a numerical value. It
right.
comes down to the je ne sais quoi of how are these needs relative to each other, and how do they all come together. Now, the obvious downside to that is now you're getting into a subjectiveness state of sending someone a ribbon or nothing and saying, trust me.
Yeah.
Yes.
And how are these changes explained, and were they pretty widely accepted? Well, of course, they had to have been, because there's no other choice, right? I mean, it is what it is. You either enter and go along with the rules, or you don't and say, hey, oh, well. Did they give any explanation as to why they made these judging changes at all? Or?
There were some explanations given. Off the top of my head, I don't recall exactly. It came down to versus the previous judging forms. They felt this one was a little bit more succinct and a little bit better organized. Overall, you know, with anything new, a lot of the judges were scratching their heads Thursday when we saw these, and kind of going, okay, well, so we do this, we do that. I guess that's interesting. This is good. I kind of like the way we did it before. I think overall, by the time we got to the Saturday morning judging, pretty much everybody was like, well, okay, yeah, we can work this. This is good. This is good.
Probably because they were all soused trying to recover from the night before. Well, interesting stuff, Jeff. You know, for sure, you know, something to think about, you know, when we consider entering, you know, the Major Cup, you know, next year. You know, and maybe we ought to, you know, maybe we need to have a business meeting and talk about, you know, and here we go again. I mean, you know, Homebrew Con, Major Cup. You know, which one do we go to? Do we go to both? Do we go to one? I mean, that's something we need to talk about for sure.
Yeah. Do we send a representative to one and one representative to another? And, you know, another thing, though, you mentioned this in the last episode that I listened to on the way out there. We need hats or T-shirts or something because, like, I posted a photo middle of the day on Friday or towards the end of the day on Friday saying, hey, you know, your Mazer Cup correspondent here, blah, blah, blah. And I got a couple of comments like, I wish I knew who you were because I would have said hello. Yeah. No, need some kind of recognition there because, you know, all of the meteries and all of the meat associated people, they all have their hats and their shirts and their work shirts and stuff like that. So something to point us out as far as, you know, who we are, what we're doing there, that could be helpful.
Well, this is probably something we need to throw over to the vice president of what the hell did I call it, Ryan? Vice president, marketing director in charge of something. I don't remember. Anyway.
Yeah.
So, hat, something. We'll come up with something for sure. Facebook friends. This is going to be a regular segment each show. And a lot of folks out there that asking questions on the different Facebook groups out there. We try to be, pretty versed and go to the different groups and pick out some of the things that we think are we can help out here at the Meat House. Something that I picked up on, guys, and this is going to be more up, towards Ryan's deal here. This comes from Tony Qualls in the Modern Mead Makers group. And a big old paragraph, a couple of paragraphs he puts up there, but the gist is, Ryan, he's looking to do some session meads. And sounds like he's going to set up kind of a number of test batches. And he's chosen D47, SO4, which I think is a great one. QA23, which I've used before, had decent results. DV10 for the trials, and he's looking for 2 to 4 other options for this test. And the base honey is going to be this SB Farm Star Thistle or some quality, or same, I think what he meant was same quality wildflower. So what are you thinking in terms of doing a session mead when it comes to a yeast or several yeasts?
Well, I'll give them 2.5 suggestions. The first suggestion is with session strength meads, I like using beer yeasts. I think they can provide some really nice qualities and some little bits of nuance, especially with something that is going to be a little lighter, a little let's just say a little bit lighter in body and alcohol, and you can pick up some additional flavors from. The first one is just a classic US05. That's a clean fermenting yeast. It's going to showcase the honey a little bit. I think that, and it's a tolerant, kind of a yeast. Temperature tolerant, nutrient, pretty easy going. So that's good. I also like using Saison yeast. I would jack up the temperature to the upper range. 3711 is a French Saison yeast that I like from Y Yeast, which has a very high tolerance. I think it's about 12-13% tolerance. There are some other Saison yeast that can handle like into the 80s, 85 degrees and really throw semesters. I think those can be fun if you can maintain that temperature. 3711 is going to throw some great esters in kind of the mid-70s. So you don't need to get quite as high. I mean, even down in probably 70, it's going to throw some great esters. So again, you can do that. I'd love to try that, I love using that one. I think he'll enjoy trying it. Those are two. The third one, this is kind of that half suggestion. I've only used it once. Is Y Yeast 2633. That is the Oktoberfest Lager Blend. That one is designed just to produce a rich, malty, complex, and full-bodied beer. It attenuates well, leaving plenty of malt character and mouthfeel, and it's low in sulfur production. I've only used this one once. I did not have the best temperature control. This is a lager yeast, so you definitely want it kind of in the 40s or 50s through its fermentation. I was up in the 60s. I was in the low 60s, so I was probably five degrees higher than its upper range or upper recommended range. It did, on a session traditional to me, come out very white wine-like. Overall, I really liked it. I want to play with this one again. I think it's got a lot of great characteristics, or a lot of, if you are able to maintain more of a lager temperature with it, maybe in the upper 50s, maybe mid 50s. I don't know if I'd go down in the 40s. But that would be the other one that I would try. So there's kind of 2.5 suggestions for Tony on some yeast to play with his session project.
Good stuff. Good stuff. And then one other one I had here, guys, Jack Tinstone. This is going to be more towards Jeff here. He simply asked, can you use tea bags to flavor a mead? And of course you can, but let's let Jeff go in a little bit more detail here before we move into a couple of things that Ryan and Jeff both had for our Facebook friends.
So, yes, you can use tea bags to flavor a mead. Generally, when I hear about people using tea bags in mead, what they're talking about doing is taking a basic black tea and using that to add some tannin character. One of the things that I've really liked doing, you guys know that I'm a metheglin guy through and through. I have made more than one tea mead, including like that hibiscus chamomile that is on our website. That took, I think that was my first cup from Mazer Cup that I took home. I started that by basically steeping some hibiscus and some chamomile. And I used that in place of the water for my mead. And I've done that steeping process a number of different ways. I tried some kind of teas that a tea seller at our local farmer's market makes and got, you know, okay results from. The long and short of it, I wouldn't use a commercial tea bag because I would use a more specialized blend. Unless you're getting really premium tea by the bag, I would go search out the best darn tea you can find and use that. I mean, be very selective. Don't be afraid to pay a little bit of a premium for really good quality tea if you're looking for a lot of flavor because, you know, like Ryan is so fond of saying, crap in, crap out.
Yeah, exactly. Good stuff. Jeff, you also had somebody from Facebook friends here you wanted to throw a shout out to, or somebody who had a question, I think you said.
Yeah, I've got a question. I've also got a couple really quick shout outs that I wanted to throw out here. Speaking of the hibiscus chamomile mead, you guys know we've mentioned a couple times on the show, Eric Bosick had tried brewing this a while back. And I think I sent a picture out of a really gorgeous bottle that he made. He did a gorgeous label, a little like shrink wrap, very well presented. And I was blown away by it. You know, really great presentation. Well, you know, he and I have been talking off and on, and he lives in Japan, and he got a really awesome opportunity. He actually did a collaborative brew with, I believe it's Itai Brewing in Tokyo. That's loosely based off of my hibiscus and chamomile mead. Now he had to make a lot of adaptations to it to kind of fit with some of those idiosyncrasies of the Japanese brewing industry's rules and regulations. So it's, as he told me, it's a little bit of it's more of a session mead, and it has just a very small amount of malt character to it because it needs to essentially be a little bit malty to be made by a beer brewery. They've done a pilot batch. It's in the fermenters and it's going well. I actually shared a post that he sent to me on our Facebook page just a few minutes ago. I should have put more detail into that because of some of that got lost along the way. But yeah, this mead that is loosely based on a recipe that won a Mazer years and years ago is now in production in Tokyo, and I think, if I remember right from what he said, this is one of the first metheglins actually being made available in Japan. So I am extremely proud and pleased to be, you know, in my own small way helping metheglins get to Japan.
Awesome. Awesome. Good stuff. What else did you have?
So there was one other quick throw out I wanted one other quick mention I wanted to throw out here. Sean Grant commented on some of my haphazard post of the results of Mazer Cup that he was listening to our podcast with Josh Mahoney talking about how he step fed his braggot, and then he applied that to one of his recipes. Of course, Josh Mahoney took first in braggots again, but Sean Grant took third using that technique that he got from awesome. Josh Mahoney.
Awesome.
And, you know, he wanted to say, hey, thank you for the good information. Thank you for listening, Sean, and thank you for, you know, using what you've applied and proving that, you know, this is good stuff.
We need to get Josh booked on the show again, Ryan.
Yeah, and
he'll be coming back.
To hang out with Josh and with Matt Whitey, and, you know, great guys. I really enjoyed just, you know, shooting the shit with them for a little while I was at Mazer too. So
awesome.
Very, very good times.
Awesome stuff.
Finally, here's that last question. William Michael Alderman from Brunswick, Maine, writes, "Hey there, guys. Just wanted to start out by saying your show has been incredibly informative for me as a young brewer. I want your opinion on what method do you think would be best for making a mead with beet and pomegranate with a touch of anise and clover. I had this combination in a cocktail one day, thought it was absolutely tasty. Keep up the good work, and thank you." So what do you guys think? Beet, pomegranate, anise, and clover.
I don't know what beet juice. Let me preface this by saying, first off, I have no idea what beet juice actually tastes like. Now, I like beets as a vegetable. I like pickled beets. I just don't know what beet juice adds to a mead, but I like all the rest of it. I like the anise. Beet juice. Other than color, I'm not quite sure what the beet juice is going to add to it, but I can dig the rest of it, Ryan.
Yeah. I think in case of in this case, you've got to think, okay, he's trying to deconstruct a cocktail. So it's not necessarily a wine or a beer or even a grouping of ingredients here. And the ingredients are kind of going across the spectrum here of savory, fruity, and sweet to spicy and bitter, essentially. In a cocktail where you're starting out with a high proof alcohol, and then you're adding these kind of flavors on top of it, is a little bit different than saying, how do I want to create a beer or a wine? I think the way that I would approach it, now going back to here, the cocktail, is saying that these ingredients are all put in fresh. They're putting in fresh pomegranate juice or maybe pomegranate fruit, and clove and anise are probably being added as in either a tincture form or maybe a garnish. And again, I have no idea how the beet might have been incorporated. But keeping in mind that when you had this cocktail, if it was the fresh pomegranate that you enjoyed, then that's going to be very different than putting pomegranate juice in primary. If it was a little bit of anise a piece of anise that was actually put in the cocktail as a garnish, that's very different than steeping it for 3 days,
right?
In your final mead. So I would try to think about how those ingredients were incorporated in the cocktail that he liked, and then say, is there something I can pull away by saying, okay, it was fresh pomegranate juice. It was literally, it was a whisper of anise. It was, the beet was, very light or something like that, and trying to keep in mind how can I achieve those flavors in the mead. It's adding them post fermentation or adding them maybe in secondary, and just trying to pick up those little bit of nuances. Jeff, what do you think?
Well, I'm going to go a different direction. I'm going to say, blending here could be your friend. What I would do is I would go get a couple pint jars and some good neutral spirits like vodka. I would make yourself an anise tincture and a clove tincture. Start those right away so that they got time to sit. And then I would make yourself a pomegranate mead and a beet mead. I'm not sure how to approach this because let's be honest, you're not going to put whole pomegranate into a mead. You're probably going to juice it At the very least, you're going to get some fresh pomegranate, and you're going to go through that awful, painstaking process of separating all those little juice-filled packets from the
or just massive, get the juice.
Right. But I would strongly suggest just go buy juice. Or, yeah. I forget whether it was Steve or James from Basic Brewing Radio when we had them on. They talked about a pomegranate molasses that you can pick up at like Middle Eastern markets. I've heard good results can be had with that instead. I would do either the juice or the molasses. I would make a mead like that. With the beets, I don't know if you would use whole beets. I don't know if you would.
Well, my question, let me interrupt you there, because something just occurred to me. I don't know about red beet. Now, there's another kind of beet out there that I have. It's been so long ago, but that I heard that has been used in making mead, and that's the sugar beet, which adds something a little bit different. So we're talking, you know, as far as beets go, we're talking same family, but two different animals.
Right.
How does that go? Same species, but two different breeds? I don't know. I just don't know what red beet, because
Yeah. Well, and I think this is part of the challenge that I'm putting out here is, you know, do a little homework. I can tell you that, yeah, there are sugar beets that have a long and storied history of being used in alcohol. You know, I've mentioned before, I lived in Prague for a few years, and there is a local variation of rum that's made with locally grown sugar beets instead of sugar cane. It has a flavor all by itself that is, you know, it's almost reminiscent of a spiced rum because of the earthy quality that those sugar beets give. I don't think I would honestly even put it up against a generic Captain Morgan in terms of flavor or character, but it's kind of reminiscent of it.
And I don't know how much a sugar beet would contribute to flavor as much as just add the fermentables part. Interesting concept, though. I would warn him, though, on the anise and the clove, a little bit of those, either one of those, goes a really long way.
Absolutely. And The long and short of this is, once you've got a good pomegranate mead and you've got a good beet mead, then, you know, mix those two in quantity and see, you know, do I like a little more beet? Do I like a little more pomegranate? And then very carefully just add your anise and your clove tincture to get those contributions of flavor and kind of see, you know, how you want to scale that mixture up to make make a bigger bottle. This is not an easy project. These multi-ingredient meads seldom are, but I think that's going to give you the most control over your final outcome rather than doing six or seven batches with varying degrees of one or the other or the third in various quantities and ending up with a lot of stuff that either gets, you know, if you're in my house, drank in shame when no one else is around. If you're in JD's house, it gets poured down the drain.
I like to think of it as sewer cleaner. Hey, William, I hope, I don't know if we cured your deal there, but, certainly made an attempt at trying to help you out there. So I hope you get something out of it. And let us know what kind of beet you're actually thinking about. I'm very curious about that part. And guys, that's going to wrap the show for this week. Good stuff. Jeff at the Mazer Cup, glad you had a good time there. Looking forward to next year's Mazer Cup, and hopefully we can have a booth there and perhaps even do a show there. I'm kind of excited about this. The next show on the 27th, we talked a little bit as we wrapped last week, Ryan. Chrissy, I'm going to butcher this last name, I'm sure. Chrissy Zerpour. She's written a book called The Art of Mead Tasting and Food Pairing. And I know all three of us should have a copy of it by now. I've kind of thumbed through it. Ryan, I got your email today. You've thumbed through it. Some interesting things there. And if you like cooking with wine, there's no reason why you wouldn't like cooking with mead. Now, I got to, you know, I can speak from experience about this because I took a, I don't remember who sent the sample around, guys, but it was a very berry mead. It was a strong berry character to it. And I poured the whole thing into a saucepan and reduced it down way more than half, probably two thirds. And I used it, put a little brown sugar with it, and used it as a glaze on a pork roast. Dude, let me tell you, that was awesome. So Chrissy's going to be with us next week and really looking forward to speaking to her about cooking with mead, even food pairing. I mean, I kind of get into that. I mean, you know, the white wine with the fish and light meats, the dark wines with the bread meats and so on and so forth. I can go along with that, especially when you're entertaining. I think it would go a long way. So really looking forward to that show, guys. In the meantime, I guess, Jeff, it's your turn. If you want to hit the lights and slam the door shut, we're out of here. We'll see everybody next week. Say goodnight, guys.
Goodnight, guys.
Goodnight, guys.
All right, we're gone.